Hello, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hi, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
And wow, we've got two big scoops of reality today.
Yeah, I love it. I should have maybe just picked one, but they seem to go together.
I completely understand why you did. So what we're talking about is J.R. Tolkien. Is this a short story? I don't know, this a novelette?
It's a short story.
Yeah. It's Leif by Niggle by J.R.R. Tolkien. And by his good friend C.S. Lewis, we have a short novel called The Great Divorce. Both pieces of allegory, right?
Yep. And I want to say that I always avoided The Great Divorce because, you know, thanks to this name, which the publishers fought him over because they wanted to name it this. I always thought it was about marriage.
They wanted to name it The Great Divorce, not him?
Yeah, he wanted to call it something like Going Home or How to Get Home or We Come Home or something like that, yeah. And which I don't think is any better, really, but they called it The Great Divorce.
And yeah. I saw something that it said that there was a William Blake poem called The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. And this was supposed to be, that's, you know, what the title was referring to.
Got it.
Because he was re-separating them, you know.
Well, I'm not that smart.
Well, I wasn't either. It just said that in something that I had read. And I assumed, oh, that's interesting. C.S. Lewis must have thought of that title.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. When you look at the title, it does just remind you of, you know, of marriage.
Yeah.
Right?
It's like a self-help book or something.
Right, right. Let's see. So yeah, they're thematically they share quite a bit. You know, that's why I was saying that I agree. In fact, how about I read the Year of Mercy is about to start on December the 8th of this year as we record this, which is in about a week. And Pope Francis put out a prayer that kind of ties into both of these. And how about I just read a little bit of it?
Sounds good.
Okay, it opens, Lord Jesus Christ, you have taught us to be merciful like the Heavenly Father, and have told us that whoever sees you sees him. Show us your face, and we will be saved. Your loving gaze freed Zacchaeus and Matthew from being enslaved by money, the adulteress and Magdalene from seeking happiness only in created things, made Peter weep after his betrayal, and assured paradise to the repentant thief. Let us hear, as if addressed to each one of us, the words that you spoke to the Samaritan woman, if you knew the gift of God. You are the visible face of the invisible Father, of the God who manifests his power above all by forgiveness and mercy. And I'll stop there. Amen.
It's beautiful. Amen.
Yeah, it's really nice. And then it goes on. It's about twice as long as that. But that's what we're talking about here, isn't it? Mercy.
Yeah. These stories seem really different. And the thing I like about them, both of them are somehow or other almost always in my mind, helping me to live here and now, thinking about trying to get to heaven. And Leif by Niggle is a story that Tolkien said he woke up one morning and it was pretty much complete in his head. His daughter said that it was unlike all his other work, which he would write and rewrite and change around. This he pretty much just wrote down and it was done. So it's really unusual for him. Yeah, and it's the story of a little man named Niggle who was an artist. He was particularly good at painting leaves. But he had a big painting of a tree and a far country that he was working on, and he kept getting interrupted all the time by his friends and neighbors and other people to go do the regular stuff of life. And eventually, he had to go on a long journey and undergo some therapy, some healing for his illness, and he winds up in a beautiful far country. And then And of course, it's more complicated than that. It's mm-hmm. quite densely packed for a short story. And then you have C.S. Lewis writing about the Great Divorce. He starts off in a very gray, kind of nondescript town, waiting in line for a bus. And everybody in line for the bus is very unpleasant. And they're all fighting with each other. And when he gets on the bus, it continues. Everybody's trying to show how important they are. And the bus finally gets to its destination. He gets off and he discovers that they are indeed ghosts, because everything there hurts you when you walk on it. The grass is like diamonds. The everything is your feet. It goes right through your feet. And there are guides on the way. And it turns out, of course, that they have been in hell. So it's like his very mini version of the Divine Comedy, in a way. They've been in heaven, this middle ground where you can listen to the guide that is sent, who you will know and listen to the most of all, who will give you the advice of what you need to give up. And usually it's just ideas or attitudes that are internal, so that you can change and become who you should be and go on to the next final resting place, which is heaven. And where you'll see the face of God. And we never see heaven, but what we see along the way are all the different struggles that all these kinds of people have.
And, yeah, and I thought that was a really interesting aspect of it. So these people are in hell, and they get on a bus and go to a field from which they can see heaven, right? And,
yeah.
And that's just an interesting concept. It's like, you know, all right, everybody, you know, pile in. We're going to have a little bit of a break. And then it's as if they are being given an opportunity to leave hell by people that are trying to convince them to drop what it is that's holding them back. And they talk to several different people who have several different issues.
Yeah, which is very much in the way that Lewis would like to look at things. And he is one of the people, obviously. And so he has his own guide, who is George MacDonald, who is a early writer of fantasy. And he was also a minister and wrote a lot of very inspirational works. And both of those inspired tons of people. I was really surprised when I was looking him up last night to see that not only was he really influential on C.S. Lewis, but there are people like, I think, the poet Auden, maybe. Mm-hmm. And G.K. Chesterton said that The Princess and the Goblin totally changed his life when he read it. I was surprised at how many people he had influenced when he's not very well known now. So
yeah, I didn't realize who he was, but I felt that it was special, you know, because, you know, he's called George MacDonald in there. And it was only in discussion with you that I knew that he was a real person.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was interesting too, because I don't know if they ever met, because he died in 1905. So it was only his writing that was influential to Lewis. Whereas the other people that you see, almost pretty much everybody they're meeting who, as a guide, was somebody from their life. You know, most people were influenced by people in their own life, not people that they read.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah, which I think is the case for most people.
Right, right.
So both of these show you different attitudes that somehow go together like folded hands, of the way to look at how do you live your life now, what are the things that you need to either leave behind or change attitude-wise, and then that should influence your actions. I would say that Leaf by Niggle is much more oriented to action and intention being tied together, because Niggle, even though he goes and he'll do the things that he's asked to do, like help his neighbor when the wife is sick and the roof is coming off, he's complaining to himself, such as I'm very familiar with.
and me. When,
later in Judgment, that's kind of being held against him by one of the judges. You know, it's like, well, but he kept complaining about these things.
Yeah.
You know, so, right. And Lewis's talks about, it does talk about how that affects the people's actions, but they're trying to get people to give up their intentions at that moment that are bad or their wrong way of looking at things so that they can fulfill their potential.
Right, right. Yeah, I was interested in an aspect as well. You know, Tolkien and Lewis were very good friends. And I just looked it up. You know, Leaf by Niggle was written in 1938 and 39. Mm-hmm. But it was published in 1945.
Right.
And then The Great Divorce was published in 1944 and 45 in a serial, magazine. Okay. So that aspect, I just wanted to throw that out there because it interested me. Mm-hmm. You know, these two guys, you know, I imagine had lots of conversations about this kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You can imagine they did. I don't know if you want to talk about each thing separately.
Yeah, I'm not. I don't know. I think, you know, we can interweave them. But let's from this point in the podcast on, let's assume that people have read these. If you haven't, you know, I certainly urge you to do so. They're both very well worth reading. But yeah, let's not worry about spoilers and dig right in.
Okay.
I don't know if you want to talk. We could talk about the differences between the two, or
let's talk about each one separately, just a little bit. Like what hit you or what you liked or didn't like about maybe Leaf by Niggle.
Okay. Yeah. Let's start with Leaf by Niggle.
Of course.
Yeah. So if we start with Leaf by Niggle by Tolkien,
which I love this story, and the first time I read it I was so surprised because it just seemed like a basic little story, and I was like and then I listened to Corey Olson, the Tolkien professor, who did two separate classes on it in his undergraduate Tolkien class that he put online, and I went, whoa, okay.
Yeah, I love Corey Olson, by the way.
Yeah.
Very nice, yeah. But yeah, on my first read, I want to mention, the first time I ever heard about this story, I was at a convention, and there was a guy there giving a Tolkien presentation, and I knew it was important because the fellow choked up when he talked about it.
Wow.
It was very important to him. And, you know, he was talking about, have you read anything else that Tolkien has done to the group? And he visibly choked up. And when I read this book the story the first time, you know, I could definitely feel that it was about purgatory or the preparation to get to heaven. I just thought it was fascinating because the first thing, it captured me immediately because, like Niggle, there are things that I want to do in life that I am constantly being taken away from. Sometimes it's hard to keep your perspective and not, you know, get angry or whatever, you know, because there are certain things that we have to do in life, you know, and it's a problem to fixate on one thing. But there have been times in my life where I've been really angry and frustrated that I wanted to do something that was personally important, but other people's importance trumped it, right? Mm-hmm. And it was probably the correct thing for other people's, you know, when you look back on things, you're like, well, that was selfish of me to fixate on that when, you know, obviously these other things needed my attention, and rightly so.
Well, and I think we've all had that experience. And I would say one of the things I liked about what happens in this story is that he shows eventually not just Niggle's side where it's the artist or the writer or the impractical seeming person to the practical people. You also see his neighbor Parrish's side once they get to where they're with the tree. And what you realize is Parrish was too practical. He never made allowance for the more intangible things, I guess you would say, of life. So where Niggles is busy, you know, doing things, he's making the garden, he's, you know, working on the house, and he needs Parrish's advice because Parrish knows all the practical stuff, but Parrish is lying around admiring a flower or looking at the tree and finally going, hey, that's your tree, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's, and that was later, right? So
right, that's toward the end.
Yeah.
But what it is the idea that while Niggle was in the workhouse having to paint a board one color and, and you know, dig a hole or whatever, right. Parrish was probably having to sit around and listen to classical music or look at a painting or I don't know what.
Yeah, and it was that was such a fascinating aspect to it because – you know, it helps us learn to see things from someone else's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we first meet Parrish, you know, we meet a man who has no appreciation for Niggle's painting, right? So Niggle is painting this huge picture of a tree and with intricate leaves, and he keeps coming back to it and back to it, and it just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And he's painting the things that are behind the leaves that you can see through the tree. And he's just constantly thinking of things. And when I loved how it was described, it was like he didn't paint a bird somewhere. It was as if the birds arrived and he somehow had to incorporate them into the painting. You know, so it was both real and magical at the same time.
A wonderful look at the creative process.
Right, right. So, and yeah, I've heard writers talk about that too. It's like, you know, when you create these characters, sometimes they take off on their own, and the story takes you somewhere that, you know, you didn't outline or whatever, but it takes you somewhere because of, you know, of what makes sense of your creative process, right?
Right.
And it's the same thing I felt like he was describing here. It was like, okay, well, this painting somehow needed a bird. And somehow the bird arrived, and somehow Niggle is going to put that in there. But then you have Parrish at the beginning who has no appreciation for that. He looks at that, and I can't even remember what he said specifically, but it was like, you're completely wasting your time. Well, I need your help. I need your help on this. Yeah.
Yeah. Ahead. At one point, this is when his wife is sick and the wind has blown the tiles off his roof. And he says, what I need is for you to bring over some canvas, board and paint and help me with it. And that's the first time he looks directly at the painting, like, and it's right there.
Right.
That's what it's good for.
Yeah. That's what it's good for. Right. And Parrish did, there was something preventing Parrish from doing a lot of things on his own, and I forget exactly.
He had a hurt leg.
Hurt leg, okay. Yeah, but he had an issue that he couldn't do certain things by himself, so there wasn't a lot of neighborhood around, so Niggle was his go-to man.
Right? Yeah, and I liked the point where every so often they'd go, you should have helped him with that roof. That's the law, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so you got the idea that there was this underlying law that you had to help other people, you had to do these things, and if you didn't, you were going against it. And I loved that kind of, that it's the acknowledgement of that underlying thing that lies within our own hearts of, that makes you, for instance, when you were talking about, I was working on this thing and I'd resent it, that I'd have to stop and do things for other people.
Right.
Or for my family or whatever, because you know what's most important. You have to do it. It's the attitude with which you do it, though.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Do you fight it? Are you obedient to it, even though you're trying to fight it? Because later when he's in the dark listening to the two voices, you know, the first voice, the stern voice is saying, well, and he looked at them as interruptions, and the gentler voice is saying, well, you know, to him that's what they looked like, but he still did the things.
Right, so he stopped painting in order to go somewhere on an errand for Parrish in the rain on his bicycle and ended up dying.
Yeah.
Right, from sickness that he got on that. And while he was laying there, we heard two voices. And I think that's when it gets really super interesting. He said, I don't have it underlined, but didn't he say it was something like, I overheard something that was like a court of inquiry or something like that. I can't remember the exact sentence. He thought it was one of two things. It was like,
Now he heard voices, and this is with a capital V, not voices that he had heard before. There seemed to be a medical board or perhaps a court of inquiry going on close at hand in an adjoining room with the door open, possibly, though he could not see any light.
Right, right. Yeah, so he hears two voices that are talking about him.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, one is a severe voice.
Yeah, one is a severe voice, kind of judgmental. Mm-hmm. And the other one is extremely kind.
I liked the description. It said, a voice that you might have called gentle, although it was not soft, it was a voice of authority and sounded at once hopeful and sad. And later on, the first voice says, well, you do have the final judgment on these things, and it is your point, your task, of course, to put the best interpretation on the facts. Sometimes they will bear it. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, of course, this is Jesus, God and Jesus. You know, you've got the classic ideas of justice and mercy, but right. They're both balanced out.
Which is funny. It's funny how that comes up again, because, yeah, you need both, right?
Right.
Yeah.
You've got to have... The second voice never says that the first voice is wrong. It just says, well, let's look at all the details about everything. And one of the things he says is, he was a little man. I didn't underline this either, but he says he was little and he was never meant to be anything big. And I hate to say it, I kind of looked at that and took comfort. Mm-hmm. It was like, you know, we all have to try as heroically as we can, but a lot of times our own efforts are things like being heroic about, I will do the podcast only from this time, because then I have to go to work and then I have to get breakfast going or I have to do whatever. And I could sit here and talk about this stuff all day long.
Yeah, yeah.
But if these are my struggles and I feel like, well, this is dumb because this is not a big deal. Well, it's a big deal to me. We all can't be great men or great women or whatever. Our little struggles right where we are also matter. We're not all meant to be big. A lot of us have to be little. That's how the world works. Mm-hmm. And it's not saying that little is bad. Look at the difference Nigel makes with his tree when he's fulfilling his potential.
Right, right. Yeah, and we live in a world that seems to constantly tell us that, hey, if you're not rich and famous, you're probably not very important.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, especially just, you know, we follow a lot of Kardashians as a planet, which
well,
is inexplicable.
The
yeah, and but yeah, the whole self-worth, you know, all of us are unique and of great worth, which is, you know, the value of life that the Catholic Church teaches.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and a lot of what's really interesting, and that's why I say this story is so dense. When you reread it, you see a lot of different aspects. But when Nigel gets to his almost fully realized tree, that's real, he sees that the best, most characteristic Nigel leaves are the ones that were done with Parrish.
Yeah, yeah.
Which he would never have known, but somehow the miraculous having to interact with Parrish made those leaves the best.
Exactly, yeah. So after he passes on, which you don't fully understand, right?
Right.
It doesn't say in there that Nigel died and now this.
And he had to go on a journey.
Yeah, he's just on a journey and he's like, holy cow, that's my tree.
Mm-hmm.
And it's real. And he's looking at it and then Parrish is there. And then we get into what you were talking about Nigel being in, he's building stuff and painting, you know, like you were saying, he's in this workshop doing all this stuff that he resented.
Mm-hmm.
And Parrish is outside looking at flowers.
Oh, well, that's, no, when yeah. he's in the workshop, he doesn't know, he's not talking to anybody else. When Parrish, the part I'm talking about is after they've both been let out of the workhouse.
Okay.
And he's with his tree that's growing out in the country. And at one point he's walking around saying, well, I really need Parrish. Parrish is the one who knows about dirt and planning. And mm-hmm. then Parrish shows up and Parrish says, I have to thank you for putting in a good word for me. They said you needed me. And so that's
awesome.
When they're both,
yeah.
he's doing, it says surprisingly, he was doing all the work and Parrish would come up with the plans, but he wouldn't do a lot of work. But it was
right.
all fun.
Okay. Yeah. So that, yeah. yeah. So, yeah. So he's busy working.
Yeah.
And Parrish is busy looking at flowers. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't know that you get the sense that Parrish is doing something not worthwhile. And I don't know that Nigel has any feelings that he's saying, well, he should be helping me.
No, because right. this is still part, you get the sense that this is still part of purgatory.
Right. And that, I think that's when, you know, you realize exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
Is because it's like they're doing this stuff with pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe a little bit of confusion. But it's almost as if, well, we should be doing this.
Yeah,
this is what you should be doing, and this is what I need to be doing. Oh, not unlike the painting earlier that needed the bird.
Right.
It was somehow, it just, this is the way it needed to be. And they both accepted it, and they mm-hmm. both were doing it. And they were opposites in life, and they're opposites in death, because they're both doing what needs to be done for themselves. Right.
Right. They're both becoming more fully themselves, and in working together on this tree, they're helping each other to do that at the same time. But you don't, during the whole thing when they're working on the tree, yes, there's never a sense of compulsion other than an inner sense of, oh, well, there's still more to be done, but I need some help. They're really enjoying it,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
And it's, you can tell they're still working things out, because they both got given a tonic by the doctor, mix it with a little spring water and take it if you get a little confused or don't feel good or something, and that would kind of straighten them out and clear their heads, and they could rest and think again. And then later it's time for Niggle to move on. He's ahead of Parrish. Parrish is waiting for his wife.
Yeah.
He's not ready to move on, but Niggle wants to go with that shepherd, and so mm-hmm. those mountains are calling
yeah,
to
him. Yeah, and if there was any doubt by that time in the story, you know, it's all gone. You know, so he's like, you know, okay, well, I'm going to move on to the mountains with this shepherd.
Mm-hmm.
And, but Parrish, even though he wants to go, is not ready.
Yeah.
And he knows he's not ready, and he chooses to stay and wait for his wife.
Right.
And, yeah, beautiful stuff.
Well, when you said that there's never a sense that Parrish is slacking off or whatever when he's looking at flowers, that that's still worthwhile, one of the first points that's made in Niggle's favor by the second voice is he was a painter by nature, in a minor way, of course. Still, a leaf by Niggle has a charm of its own. And so that in itself is a point in his favor, the fact that he was an artist.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of interesting. And you wonder if for Parrish, they go, well, let's look at this. He was a gardener. He grew the best potatoes in town. You know, you just kind of can look at that and go, the things that we don't know matter,
yeah.
do matter on some kind of a bigger scale.
Yeah, and it also makes you realize that everybody's got something, you know.
Yeah. Exactly. That we might not
even that we may not understand or appreciate, but
yeah.
there's, you know, we've all got something.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Beautiful story.
Yeah, and well worth reading and mm-hmm. rereading, and actually I like it so much. And it's not available recorded in this country due to copyright issues. And I'm thinking, you know, really, because Derek Jacobi has read it and some of Tolkien's other short stories, and you can get them in the UK, but because of copyright issues, you can't get them here. And I'm like, I'll pay. Why does this make it a copyright issue? Mm-hmm. Are we never allowed to have an audio recording of this? So I recorded it for myself so I could listen to it every so often.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. It's not a perfect recording because I just read it for myself, but, mm-hmm. you know, it's nice to have it.
Very nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Hey. So this one, you would say, is really about purgatory. It's about the purification of the person on the way to heaven.
Oh, I think it's about the whole life journey.
Okay.
I mean, the middle part is purgatory. I mean, you just mm-hmm. see the glimpse of heaven at the end, but you see some of his life at the beginning, so you have the context.
Yeah, so it gives you the base from which he has changed, right?
Well, and you get, after he's gone and he doesn't care about this stuff anymore, you find out that other people really didn't appreciate him. They show you a glimpse of the real world again.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that's left after, I guess, all his painting is torn up to fix that roof or various other things, there's one leaf by Niggle left that winds up in the museum, which eventually burns down and no one remembers him at all. But nobody cares, because the work that you did mattered, and it clearly matters later on in a way we can't understand. But if it's not remembered later, okay. Yeah. It doesn't matter.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about that that mm-hmm. detail. But you're right, yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway, it's just, yeah. I love it just as a way to look at my life and to remind myself of, it just take me out of myself, I think. It's when we're so self-absorbed that we run into danger.
Agreed, yeah. Excellent. And then The Great Divorce kind of comes at the same type of thing, but in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so like you said, it starts off in hell, and this fellow getting on a train that we're not sure where it's headed, but it ends up, it goes to this field from which you can see a city.
Right.
Right? And then the city is where everybody seems to want to go. They talk fondly of the city, but yet there's something holding all of these people back from finishing the journey. You know, the guy on the bus or the driver is like, you know, hey, I'll wait as long as you guys want. And it was just, you know, it was really interesting how, you know, you knew something was odd because, you know, at the beginning, everybody's getting on this bus and there's like fighting and jostling in the line. And then mm-hmm. he finally gets on and he noted that the bus was only, you know, half full. And yeah. Which was interesting. So that, I mean, there were a lot of people that were so self-absorbed that they had no idea to take advantage of this bus that was going, you know, to this field.
Mm-hmm.
That was an interesting statement as well. It was like, you know, many people didn't even have the wherewithal to know to get on the bus, much less get to the field and then not know to go farther.
And you could take the bus back if you wanted. So mm-hmm. in one sense, it's a very interesting look at the idea that you choose hell for yourself. Because often I'll say, oh my gosh, if you're given the choice, why would you ever turn away from God? You know, when you're ultimately face to face, how could you turn away from, as Pope Francis put it, that gaze? Mm-hmm. Of that second voice, as Tolkien put it. And this shows that it's everybody who does it has two things. They're very self-absorbed and they won't listen to anyone else. And they're afraid of the pain, which I'm probably definitely in the first category, but I know I'm in the second category. Mm-hmm. That you have to walk over the blades of grass that cut your feet and hurt you. You have to maybe like when that lizard on that guy's shoulder is being killed, it really hurts as if he's being killed. But once that pain's done, we're allowed to see from that example the glory that can come after.
Right. Yeah, and it's interesting that you say, you know, well, we choose hell for ourselves. Because that is what the Catechism says. It doesn't mm-hmm. say that everybody that's not Catholic goes to hell.
No.
and we're not people that are supposed to be pointing it and making that determination. As in, you know, well, this group of people is definitely going to hell, and so is that guy, and, well, she's definitely going. If somebody's doing that, that's not proper.
Right.
It's not even the proper way to be thinking.
Right. We don't know what God sees in each person's soul.
Exactly.
He knows
right.
the yeah. struggles. He knows the potential.
Right.
He knows what we've done and haven't done.
Yeah, intention and desire means so right. much for Catholics.
And if even though Catholics, you know, will come right out there and say, you know, we've got the best explanation of a lot of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But just because you don't apply our explanation doesn't mean you can't wind up there.
Absolutely right.
Whether you've ever heard of Christ or not, whether you've accepted him or not, that's, you can find Christ in all kinds of ways that aren't defined technically.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that's one of the interesting people in here is somebody who he wants to lecture about religion. and they're like, that's like talking about a glass of water instead of taking a drink when you're thirsty.
That's right. Was it C.S. Lewis? I can't remember who said that, but it's like, you know, some people, if given the choice of going to heaven or attending a lecture about heaven, would go to the lecture about heaven, right?
I think that's it. And I think he did say that. And this person is living out that illustration because his idea of religion is more important to him than opening his eyes and seeing what's going on. Because really, they don't mention religion except in cases like this where somebody's obsessed with it. Religion's not mentioned for most of the people in the field who are talking to their guides who are coming out to try and help them get to that city.
Yeah, and that's absolutely right. He's not, you know, he's not saying that at all. It's like, watching a show. I can't remember. There was a few things. Rowan Atkinson once did a skit where he's talking to people in hell. He says, "Yes, I'm the devil," and everything. And you know, everybody that's in here, all the Catholics go over here. And he says, "I'm sorry, but the Jews were correct." You know, everybody's like, "Oh," you know.
Yeah.
So, but that's not what he's doing in this book at all. He's not mm-mm. saying, you know, those people that are this are all here, and that's all that's here, and now these people in that group are having specific other problems. You know.
Yeah.
This is very human. Very. It's extremely interesting the people that he starts to go through.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, because I didn't get the feeling at all that I don't know that he mentions Christianity specifically. Well, no, he does a little bit, but
well, some because you can't talk about heaven and hell. But
right.
he is really he's expressing greater goods in terms of things like, you know, there's a flock of or a herd of unicorns that go through at one point. There's the lizard that gets killed turns into a gorgeous stallion.
Yeah.
You know, I loved that visualization of the idea that our sins are really perversions of things that are meant to be great goods. Right. In this case, the man's lust was a perversion of a desire for something that was the desire itself is not bad until the man put his perversion in there.
Right.
And
right.
so it turns into something that can carry him to heaven. It was really great. And then, but he's got people like, you know, the artist who's so worried and upset because his paintings aren't remembered on Earth anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And he just wants to go and paint. And the guy's like, no, what you loved was the light. That was your love. You wanted to paint in order to tell about the light. And he goes, "Oh, well, that's ages ago. One grows out of that, you know." And he's like, "No, see, the point is."
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I wonder if that grew out of a conversation between Lewis and Tolkien, that specific example.
Could be.
Yeah.
It could be because, you know, he does talk about poets and musicians and writers. But there's also a woman who Lewis is looking at her going, we didn't understand what she was doing. She was kind of writhing around in this weird way. And then he realizes she's trying to be sexually attractive to any male who comes by. Mm-hmm. And he's like, this was a ghost. This was the most weird-looking thing ever. And it doesn't have much effect. Eventually, she just goes back to the bus because that's the only way she knows to relate to people. But one of the things I liked most is, well, in fact, he does talk about Christ. He says, "We know nothing of religion here. We think only of Christ. We know nothing of speculation. Come and see. I will bring you to eternal fact, the father of all other facthood."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was noting the same thing too. There's this quote here that I really like to read that kind of feeds into what we're saying. This person is getting information. And he says, "But what of the poor ghosts who never get into the omnibus at all? Everyone who wishes it does. Never fear. There are only two kinds of people in the end: those who say to God, 'Thy will be done,' and those to whom God says in the end, 'Thy will be done.' All that are in hell choose it. Without that self-choice, there could be no hell. No soul that seriously and constantly desires joy will ever miss it. Those who seek, find. Those who knock, it is opened."
Yeah, it's the ultimate respect of free will.
Mm-hmm. That's right, and it's a necessary respect for free will. Yeah.
Yeah, well, and when you look at it, that's, you know, for all the people who say God likes to break the rules and everything, free will is the example that God doesn't break the rules. He put that into us for a reason, and he respects it. He respects each of us so much, he will let us choose wrongly, despite trying to throw out every way to show us that we don't see, we're blind, we're like these ghosts. We've got some idea so strongly in mind, we won't open our eyes.
Right, right.
I liked that, and I cannot find this quote, but there's one of my favorite quotes is where one of the ghosts is saying to the guide, oh, so what you're saying is that I was wrong. I was all wrong. And the ghost just starts laughing. He goes, that's the great thing. We were all wrong. All of us. And when we get here, we can let that go. And then we could see what's right.
Mm-hmm.
And the ghost doesn't get it. But I was like, that's it. It's just right now here in life, we don't know where we're confused and where we aren't.
Right, right.
Which is why I love that we have a catechism, and I love that we have the church that's been in place so long that's been able to kind of go, okay, here's where you go. You may not love these things, but here's the reason for it, and here's how it builds into human dignity or getting us to heaven and all these various things. And you can go, oh, all right, some things I just have to obey whether I like them or not.
That's right. Yeah, there's another quote here that I marked that I just loved. It's a teacher, again, talking. He says, it is nearer to such as you than you think. There have been men before now who got so interested in proving the existence of God that they came to care nothing for God himself. As if the good Lord had nothing to do but exist. There have been some who were so occupied in spreading Christianity that they never gave a thought to Christ. Man, you see it in smaller matters. Did you never know a lover of books that with all his first editions and signed copies had lost the power to read them? Or an organizer of charities that had lost all love for the poor? It is the subtlest of all the snares.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's just, that's profound. I have. And I'm probably guilty of some of that.
I was going to say, I do the same thing where, you buy, I have to keep an eye on myself because I'll just buy books, but then do I read them?
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to have big stacks of books that you don't read.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yep. I've got some of that.
Well, and I also loved this point that hell is lonely.
Yeah.
Because most of it's empty, and when he's looking out, he's like, wow, there just aren't that many people around, and there's nobody in these buildings. And somebody explains to him that, well, you know, you get annoyed by all the people around you. So you can, whatever you think will happen. So you can imagine a different part of the town and a house for yourself, and you can go live there. And he said, the longer people are here, the further away they move because they just get annoyed by everyone. And so we wanted to see historical figures, and we went off to find,
Is
it Julius Caesar maybe?
Right, yeah, or Napoleon. Napoleon lived way off by himself.
Yeah, lived way out in the boonies by himself, mm-hmm. and he's just wandering around muttering about his past life
and
experience. And he seemed crazy. And so it's also that idea of you create your own hell.
Yeah. There was one point at which this woman walks by and she's just grumbling or complaining in this long paragraph, just complaining. And the guy says to the teacher, he's just asking for explanations. You know, I'm troubled because that unhappy creature doesn't seem to me to be the sort of soul that ought to be even in danger of damnation. She isn't wicked. She's only a silly, garrulous old woman who's got into a habit of grumbling and feels that a little kindness and rest and change would do her all right. And then the teacher says, well, that is what she once was. That is maybe what she still is. If so, she certainly will be cured. But the whole question is whether she is now a grumbler. I should have thought there was no doubt about that. Aye, but ye misunderstand me. The question is whether she is a grumbler or only a grumble. If there is a real woman, even the least trace of one, still there inside the grumbling, it can be brought to life again. If there's one wee spark under all those ashes, we'll blow it till the whole pile is red and clear. But if there's nothing but ashes, we'll not go on blowing them in our own eyes forever. They must be swept up. But I read that, and I feel hope in that. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, if there's the slightest trace of humanity left in you, they're going to blow on those embers and try and get you there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I liked that thought.
Yeah, and I think about what Niggle went through, and I think about what these people are going through, and you realize this whole idea of purgatory, and people object to purgatory. And actually, Lewis, though he wasn't Catholic, there's some quote, and I have it written down, of course, somewhere, where he says, don't you want to clean up before you go to a fancy banquet? Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have any problem with this whole concept.
Anglicans not share purgatory?
No, I don't think so. All right. I think Catholics and maybe the Orthodox, you know, churches. Okay. Mm-hmm. But he, you know, he was more of a free thinker about a lot of things anyway, like that. But it's this idea of, it shows you the two different ways that you wind up suffering. And people think, oh, you should just go straight to heaven, or you know, you're so wicked, you go straight to hell. And what he's showing in The Great Divorce is all the things that our individuality isn't taken away from us. We're not just blown clean. We're given the respect of, again, it's free will, that we have to cooperate with it.
Mm-hmm.
But you would want those things to go away. You wouldn't want to be around everybody and be the only grumbler.
Right, right.
You know, that would just create another version of hell, because everybody else wouldn't be fixed either, and you would be miserable. And a lot of people say purgatory isn't merciful,
mm-hmm.
or it isn't very Christian. And I like that this book shows me some of the ways I go wrong, so I can try to, you know, correct that vision and my actions, therefore. But also just this idea that it is merciful. It's just that mercy isn't always easy, and we always want everything to be super easy, or it isn't nice. Right, and then everybody starts judging God based on that. And this kind of is all coming from the fact that there's one person at the end who his guide is a saint, just a common, ordinary housewife, but who was so wonderful. And she's coming and trying to talk him, he was her husband, into letting go of everything and coming with her. Well, he won't. And she's like, oh, that's awful. But she turns around and goes back and is just as happy as ever. And Lewis says, well, you know, that's awful. Shouldn't she... Is it tolerable that she should be untouched by his misery, even his self-made misery? And his guide says, would you rather that he could still torment her? He says, well, no. And he says, well, then what do you want? He says, well, what some people say on earth is that the final loss of one soul gives the lie to all the joy of those who are saved. And the guide says, well, you can see it doesn't. He says, well, I feel like it should. And the guide says, well, that sounds merciful, but see what's behind it? The demand of the loveless and the self-imprisoned that they should be allowed to blackmail the universe, that till they consent to be happy on their own terms, no one else shall taste joy, that there should be the final power, that hell should be able to veto heaven. And then Lewis kind of says, well, I'm confused. And he goes, well, yeah, it's it's got to be one or the other. Which one do you want? And I think that's one of the things that always kind of, I don't think I would have been able to articulate it, but you always feel like, oh, but those poor people in hell. And this kind of shows you they wouldn't be happy in heaven. They can't be. They've been offered all the happiness, and they've turned it down. It's not what they want. And so should you let yourself be made miserable by that? It's like letting a kid who's having a tantrum run the whole household.
Yeah, yeah, which happens plenty, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
These days especially.
Yeah. Yeah, and it all comes back to what you're saying. You know, there's justice and mercy. Mm-hmm. You can't have one without the other, you know, because you're just creating yourself more problems.
Right.
It's almost, you know, every time you run into a problem and you're given the solution of the problem that didn't cost you anything or didn't mm-hmm. make you learn something,
mm-hmm.
Your chances of recurring that problem are pretty high.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. That's a great point.
Yeah, so it's like that way with kids too. You know, it's like, you know, you can't run around as an adult solving all their issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and because they never grow up past where they need to be.
Yeah, you have to let them live, and that's one of the problems that, you know, those helicopter parents mm-hmm. cause by trying to be so kind. It's not kind at all.
Yeah, right.
The yep. hard knocks of life are how we learn things, and they don't have to be very hard knocks for most of us, but you do have to have a real experience of things that are good and bad in order to know yourself.
Yeah, and in order to progress, in order to even desire.
To grow.
To desire to progress, too.
Yeah.
And it never stops, either. It's not something that, because I'm as old as I am, is finished. It just keeps going.
Well, yeah, and it can be in something. You make me think of, you know, Hannah just got married, and so we had her in-laws over for Thanksgiving, and her mother-in-law was telling the greatest story, which was that she's been afraid of dogs her whole life, and I can't remember if it was a brother or sister, but some relative of hers, they got a dog, and this is a very small dog, maybe Yorkie or Chihuahua size, I can't remember, but she was still afraid of it because it was a dog. And she finally said to herself, you're not going to let this control you. And she got to know that dog and really got to like it. And so then they were over here, and we have much bigger dogs than that. And we were keeping them shut away because we knew she was afraid of dogs. And my husband eventually let them out because we were all settled and we were worried about her. And she said, no. So she told the story, and she goes, and then I decided I didn't need to be afraid of any dogs because they were all going to be like this other little tiny dog. And I went, wow, this lady's in her late 70s. And I said, and doesn't that feel just as great as when you set yourself free from something else and you were younger? And she goes, it does. I feel so energized by it. It was just the greatest story.
Oh, that is so nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is great.
Yeah. You never quit growing.
Right.
If you're willing.
If you're willing, right.
But she had to put herself through that pain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm going to be afraid, but I'm going to try and conquer it.
I love it. That's really something.
Yeah. I'm going to step on that grass, even though it hurts my feet.
Heck yeah. Always do what you're afraid to do, right? There's a quote from somebody. It's like, a way to keep yourself...
keep pushing the envelope.
Keep pushing the envelope, yeah.
Yeah, keep in a safe way, of course.
In a safe way, absolutely.
We're not saying make stupid decisions. But yeah, there are always things in your life where you're held back because of something you yourself have decided or some bad experience you had or whatever.
Right.
And
I guess, you know, as we get older, we decide, you know, well, is that a direction that I feel that I need to go?
Mm-hmm.
And then if you're afraid of, you know, if you feel like you need to do that and you're afraid, that's the kind of thing that you need to face. But there are some things, you know, as you get older, you're like, well, I'm not going to go that way anyway. So,
yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It's interesting. This is making me think of, which is what these books, like you're saying, do for you. You know, mm-hmm. These are the kind of books that you're changed by reading. When you read them, and you let it affects you. So you learn things from them that help you be a better person.
And I remember they'll inspire you in ways that you don't expect if you just kind of let them in, because I know that I can't remember why I was at Mass, but I was thinking about something I was doing. I don't know, something I was writing or who knows. And I was going, but this is like nothing. This is so little. What does it even matter? Why should I even bother with it? And what popped into my head was, but a leaf by Niggle has a charm of its own. And I was like, yeah.
Nice.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. That's all right.
Yep.
It could be little. It doesn't matter. You know, you just don't know. And that's, and also you forget. I mean, at least I forget. And so when I reread The Great Divorce or Leaf by Niggle, I suddenly am reminded of the stuff that mattered the last time I read it, you know?
Yeah. And it's interesting. I have a feeling that both of these are books that, like, if you read them every year, you know, they're not long. Mm-hmm. If you read them every year for the rest of your life, you would find things in them every single time, kind of based on where you're at.
Yeah.
And you'd look at it and you'd say, oh, I hadn't noticed that before.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah.
Well, and they're good for Advent, which is kind of why I was thinking about them. As we start the new church year, think about the incarnation, think about what it means that Christ became a person. You know, we're so used to thinking about that. It's like God became a baby. And you hear that, and yeah, uh-huh. No, that's astounding.
Yeah.
When you really think about the lengths he went to get through to us, to redeem us, to save us, that's insane. That's the thing that we've gotten so used to thinking about, that we need the church year to come around. And I guess it's like these two books. It's the beauty of the liturgical year, which is that it regularly represents to us these amazing things that God has given us and done for us. Mm-hmm. So that we can then look at our lives where we are in relation to it and notice something again or for the first time, depending on where we are.
Oh, yeah. That is really nice. Yeah. It is amazing. God among us, right?
Yeah. I mean, think about it. I mean, just it's, I don't know why, a couple weeks ago, it really hit me as if I'd never heard it before. And I was just blown away, and you don't often get that because we've heard it for 2,000 years. But you know, yeah. it's insane. Only God can get away with that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I talk about rereading these books, you know, like every year or whatever. But that's what the liturgical year really is, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's like it's a wonderful way that all of this is represented to us every year. I know a lot of Catholics go through the year, but really without paying much attention to where in the year we're at and stuff. But you know, to participate in that liturgical year and to know what season we're in and feast days and things like that is really an experience I haven't seen anywhere else. And it's very worthwhile and rewarding and inspiring, yeah. Like you said.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's that thing of, and you would think, if you don't participate in it yourself, you think, all around, every year, so boring. But I'm looking outside at the fall colors, since I'm in Texas. every place else
is snow. I think it's 9 outside right now. Go ahead.
It's getting warmer. It's supposed to be up to 55 today.
Oh, fantastic.
It's pretty cold this morning. It's 34.
I love it.
Anyway, but you look at that and you go, you know what? I look forward to fall every year. I love it so much, but each one's different. Mm-hmm. And each time you approach it, you're like, ooh, is this going to be the one that has the great fall colors? Oh, I hope we have enough cold days. I hope that I get those snaps when I go outside, that bright blue sky. So it's always the same, but it's always different. And that's the beautiful refreshment that God has built into the natural year. And that's why I love that the liturgical year follows that same thing. We have the, oh, it's Advent, Christmas is coming, but where I am and how things hit me, and the fact that within the liturgical year, they've got a rotation of A, B, and C, depending on which gospel you're getting read to the most out of, Matthew, yeah. Mark, or Luke, it also refreshes it and changes it. And so it's the same but different. And if you're just even halfway trying, even just saying, leave me with a word during Mass,
mm-hmm.
you'll get something different each time. It's really great.
Just like leaves.
Oh, yes.
And not only that, but, you know, you're saying that, and just within Mass, it's the same way, too. It's like,
mm-hmm.
you know, Mass is a collection of leaves. You know, every one of them is similar in structure and almost the same, right? Yeah. But they're all different.
Yeah, it's that same beautiful, the liturgy of the word and the liturgy of the, is it the host or the Eucharist? I forgot the technical term, but anyway.
Yeah, liturgy of the Eucharist, right.
Yeah, liturgy of the Eucharist. They all have the same form, but the prayers change depending on the time of year and the readings. The collects, I love. There's a book that Anthony Solen, Solen, wrote called The Beauty of the Word, I think is what it's called. And it went through when the liturgy changed a few years ago.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It went through and looked at how did these prayers change for each different Mass. And he talks about that. And what it does is it opens your eyes up to how carefully those little four-line prayers that we don't really pay attention to were written to reinforce and emphasize different things about the readings, about that part of the Mass, about that part of the liturgical year.
Mm-hmm.
Just opens it up.
It sure does.
Yeah.
Have you gotten used to saying all of stuff now? I still, every now and then, find myself reverting.
I do too sometimes. Yeah. It's that old habit. And I always read the creed.
Mm.
There's too much in there that's changed just a little.
Yeah.
And even I could be looking at the page and my thoughts drift and I find myself saying the wrong thing because I'm not really reading. You know?
Yeah, I do. Well, I do that too. And every now and then. Yeah.
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 By the time I die.
I'm not worthy that you should enter under my roof, but only say the word and my soul shall be healed.
Yeah.
Yeah. I miss that one sometimes. I get that incorrect.
Behind me a lot. The with your spirit never bothers me.
Uh-huh.
But I'll hear people behind me saying the old response, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're all still adjusting.
It is. It's been a few years already, which is amazing.
Was it 2011, maybe?
Yeah, something like that. A few leaves back.
Yeah, a few falls and springs back.
That's right.
So, well, I'm glad you liked both these.
I sure did, yeah. And they're, you know, again, you know, it's something to add to my collection of stuff that, you know, we've read so much good stuff on this podcast, but I've got a stack of books that I just constantly go back to, and these are going to be two more. Yeah, there's no question about that.
Yeah.
These are very, very worthwhile and inspiring books. Both of them.
And not hard to read.
No, not at all. No.
I mean, it's surprising how simple they are, both of them, and how deep they are.
Mm.
Kind of like the other one that I like that we read that was similar that you chose was Introduction to the Devout Life by St. Francis de Sales. And it seems so simple.
Yeah.
And you read them each time, and depending on where you are, it changes.
Yeah. I think that, you know, C.S. Lewis actually said that. You know, he talked about books and, you know, both literature and nonfiction, but, you know, trying to define what a good book is, you know, as opposed to one that's not. And really the definition is something that you could reread or something that you'd want to reread is that's what a good book is. You know, you don't need to get more technical than that. Something that means enough to you after having read it that you would want to do that again.
Yeah.
And there's some depth of meaning inside there, you know, and both of these definitely qualify for that. But I like that definition from Lewis.
Yeah, because it's simple enough that it allows you your comfort reading. It doesn't have to always be deep.
Yeah, it doesn't always have to be good either, right?
Yeah, exactly. It could just be a good story, because that's the other thing I like, is both he and Tolkien would just read all kinds of fantasy and science fiction, and it didn't have to have a deep meaning. Or if it did and it didn't agree with them, that was okay, too. He liked Voyage to Arcturus, which I've tried to get through and couldn't. And you can see how it influenced his own science fiction work.
Mm-hmm.
And it had this weird message kind of underlying everything. But he's like, eh, whatever. Mm-hmm. Great story.
Right.
You know.
So wasn't this year sort of the year of Lewis for you?
It was.
Yeah, because I remember.
I ended up reading a lot of Lewis.
I remember you were talking about that, and it just, you know, something that you just kept returning to all year. Do you plan that at the beginning of the year? Did you think, well, this is going to be my year of Lewis?
No. In fact, I was thinking about that because each year I've been saying, okay, now these are the classics or whatever I'll try to read. And I start off the year actually working on that list. And about a third of the way into the year, I kind of go, this seems interesting. And I start I just go, oh, I just read this, and now I'm going to read this other thing by this author. And so this year has been Lewis somehow grabbed me. You know, The Problem of Pain was one of the most surprising books I ever read because, again, I thought it was about pain. These titles are terrible. I thought it was about hurting, physical pain, you know. And in a sense it was, but what it was is his comment to people who say, look at the suffering in the world. I can't believe in God.
That's right. Yeah.
And I went, oh, okay. I didn't realize I had some of those underlying, you know, problems myself thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And so it was good that way. And also gave me some great things to think about if people bring it up. But it was just a really great book. And
yeah,
I've read a bunch of his and then also a lot of Dickens in the background.
Nice.
For some reason.
I hope Dickens makes a reappearance on our podcast.
I think I could predict it.
Chances are good.
I just reread A Tale of Two Cities and was blown away again.
Oh, that's great.
I was like,
how could
I have almost forgotten the entire book? This is amazing.
Yeah. On Lewis, you know, I'm loving, you know, this was fantastic. I remember I kind of got off Lewis a little bit when years ago I read Mere Christianity, which so many people really loved. And I remember thinking, around the first half of that, it's been so long since I've read it, so I don't know if your impression is the same, but the first half of it was very interesting, and the second half of it I found very dissatisfying.
Oh.
And then, but everything else that I've read of Lewis's, which has been in dribs and drabs, I've absolutely loved.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you know, Mere Christianity is the one that keeps getting past everybody. But I don't know if people agree with me or not. But maybe I'd have to reread it so that I can specifically talk about it. But
I really liked it all the way through, and I had read it so long ago and didn't need it then. You know,
sure.
But then maybe a couple of years ago, I can't remember. But what happened is I discovered the library has all the audiobooks for Lewis. And so that was one that I listened to in audiobook form. And I don't know if that made it different because it was originally, you know, a series of talks he did for the BBC radio.
Oh, uh-huh.
And then
maybe that's why I felt that there was a clear distinction between the halves. Maybe. It was
a
subject
change
or something.
The whole thing was a series of talks he did. And so, and a lot of times one chapter or, you know, talk would be a response to questions or complaints that he received from a previous talk.
Interesting.
Where he'd say, well, I could see I didn't make this very clear. So let me talk about it like this. But maybe because I listened to it over a period of time and just absorbed it orally, that it didn't bother me. I found it surprisingly insightful in ways I hadn't remembered.
Yeah, maybe it's time for
but
me to revisit it.
That happens to me because the other one I rediscovered was Romano Guardini.
And the Lord?
Yeah, The Lord, but also I picked up, it's called The Art of Prayer, or The Art of Praying.
Art of Prayer, okay.
Wow, a little book, very simple, and I was reading it going, this is incredibly deep. I mean, it's just telling you how to pray. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I need reminders sometimes. I go, how do you do this again? I know you're just supposed to talk to God, but I'm really confused. And so I'll reread these simple things, and I was reading it going, oh, man, this is so good. And I go to Goodreads to put it in, and I'm like, oh, I read this several years ago. And I'm looking at the book going, I don't even remember it. And then it suddenly comes back to me. I actually owned it and said, this is so simple, everyone knows it, and gave it to the parish library.
Nice.
I'm like, wow, I thought I knew everything. Now I have discovered I don't know hardly anything.
Wow. Well, cool.
And so I've been reading some of his stuff. He's so good.
Nice. Yeah, it's called The Art of Praying. I just called it up.
And I recommend it to everyone. It's just amazing.
Oh, good. Okay.
You do not have to be Catholic. It's just an amazing book.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Cool. I could use that, I'm sure. Yep.
Can't we all?
Awesome. Well, all right. Let's see. We got one more for this year.
Mm-hmm.
And this was 122. I don't remember saying that at the beginning.
Oh, I don't like
so we're going to end on 123. Okay. So yeah, so our next up is a movie called Millions, which
Christmas
I have not seen. Yeah, so I'm
Danny
excited.
Danny Boyle
I like
directed it.
Very good.
I don't like anything else he's ever done, really.
I love it. I'm just doing a quick search here to see if it's on Millions. Okay, cool. All right, so I'm going to have to get the DVD in from Netflix, looks like.
Oh, it's not streaming?
Not streaming, but that's fine.
Oh, yeah. Not streaming from Amazon even? Wow.
No, Amazon I didn't check. I just checked Netflix, yep.
Got it.
Cool. Yeah,
Netflix might not have it. Okay.
All right, well, wonderful.
Well, thank you for talking about these books.
And thank you for selecting them. I love it.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. You're
all welcome. Right. Well, we'll see you in a... We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Talk to you soon, everybody.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.